And the question that I'm addressing now is iron metabolism, where is the science taking us? And you'll see the theme of questions is going to feature very much in my presentation. You've already seen my disclosures. I think Christoph has already shown you these. So what I'm going to do is now pose three questions on iron metabolism that I think are pivotal to the clinical care of anemic chronic kidney disease patients. And these questions are as follows. Why are patients with CKD prone to developing iron deficiency? How best can we detect this condition of iron deficiency in these patients? And how best can we treat iron deficiency? Three very basic questions that I think we all ask every day in our routine clinical care of CKD patients. So starting with why are patients with CKD prone to developing iron deficiency? Well, there are two aspects to this, and it's a balance. And on one side of the balance, we have to recognize that our patient population generally has a diminished appetite. They absorb iron poorly from the gut, and we'll come back to the reasons for that. They are on medications such as omeprazole and other proton pump inhibitors that will inhibit iron absorption from the gut. And there are various foodstuffs such as tea and red wine that will impact on iron absorption also. And also phosphate binders would also be relevant here. On the other side, we have to recognize that CKD patients have increased iron losses, and we know this from many studies. They have occult gastrointestinal losses that can be up to 10 times greater than the normal healthy population. They have a higher incidence of peptic ulceration. They have higher gastrin levels. They are sampled with blood much more than normal human beings. They lose a lot of blood in the dialyzer membranes. May we put many of our patients on aspirin for cardiovascular prophylaxis, and that will exacerbate the bleeding in the gut. And we give patients heparin on dialysis, and this will also exacerbate the iron losses from the gut. So it's little wonder, little surprise, that many patients with CKD develop iron deficiency. And then, of course, we come along with ESA therapy these days, and we give the patients agents to stimulate the bone marrow, and that increases the requirements for iron as well. So many of these patients simply do not have enough iron and cannot keep pace with the iron requirements for healthy bone marrow red cell production. However, we have to ask the question repeatedly again, where is the science taking us with this aspect of why patients are developing iron deficiency? And there has been a huge development in the last decade with the science. And the science is focusing on the molecule of hepcidin, which comes from the liver. And hepcidin is now the molecule that we recognize inhibits iron absorption from the gut. So many of our patients have upregulation of hepcidin. We'll come back to that. And that is the reason why they have reduced iron absorption. So that's all I want to say about the first question. The second question is, how best can we detect iron deficiency? And in order to understand the tests for measuring or detecting iron deficiency, we have to understand the very basics of iron metabolism. So when we look at iron metabolism, we recognize that we all have iron stores in the body, in the liver, in the spleen, in the reticuloendothelial system, such as the macrophages. And these stores will feed the plasma of the iron. The plasma will allow the iron to go to the bone marrow. The bone marrow will produce red cells. And as these red cells die off after 120 days, the iron will be recirculated back through the reticuloendothelial system again. So that is the very basic medical student teaching of iron metabolism. Well, how do we detect iron deficiency? We have a lot of tests in our laboratories, some of them readily available, such as ferritin. Most of us have access to measurement of serum ferritin. Well, that's a reasonable marker of iron stores, but not just iron stores. We recognize that inflammation will hugely impact on ferritin levels. We can measure iron in the plasma. We can measure the total iron binding capacity. Again, we can calculate the transferrin saturation. Okay, that's not too bad too. We can also measure the transferrin receptor. Some of us have laboratories that can measure this marker. It's not so widely used as the serum ferritin. Of course, we can do bone marrows in our patient. This is a bit invasive. They don't particularly like having bone marrows every month, so it's not a very practical way of looking at how much iron is in the body. Then we can look at the number of amount of iron in the red cell, either by measuring the reticulocyte hemoglobin content or the zinc protoporphyrin levels in red cells, or even the percentage of hyperchromic red blood cells. So we have a lot of tools at our disposal. I think the three most widely used, and certainly the three that were most quoted in the European best practice guidelines that Bernard and myself were involved in, are the serum ferritin, the two transferrin saturation, and the hyperchromic red cells. And Bernard's already alluded to these guidelines in his talk, but generally speaking, we have put cutoffs for what we think are minimum levels for treating anemic chronic kidney disease patients. But again, where is the science taking us with all this? Well, we've got to recognize now that we can measure hepcidin. We have tools available for measuring hepcidin. So where is the science taking us? Is the science taking us in that maybe in the future we'd be measuring hepcidin levels in our patients? And I'll come back to that. But lastly, the last question I want to discuss before discussing a bit more about hepcidin is how can we best treat iron deficiency? And we have two tools at our disposal here. We can obviously give oral iron tablets. Now, the beauty of oral iron, of course, is that it's very simple treatment. It's the logical, easy way to give treatment. It's very cheap. It costs a few pence in the UK, or if you're in Germany or other countries in Europe, it's just a few cents. And we can give it as tablets, or we can give it as syrup. The nice thing about the syrup, I don't know if you can see this slide, is that this hemotinic syrup is not only good for anemia and weakness, but also good for overwork and general debility. So many of you might want to buy some ferroglobin after this meeting. But this is oral iron. We have to recognize, however, that there are limitations of oral iron, and we recognize that not only do healthy patients develop gastrointestinal side effects, but stage 3 and 4 chronic kidney disease patients in this study by Chariton and colleagues have a high incidence of nausea, constipation, vomiting, diarrhea, and gastrointestinal intolerance. And we recognize that the reason for these gastrointestinal side effects is that oral iron causes a lot of oxidative stress and tissue damage in the gut mucosa, which is unpreventable with the current oral iron salts. And that means that a lot of patients do not comply with their treatment. They recognize they get these gastrointestinal side effects, and they decide that it's not an appropriate thing for them to carry on taking them, and they might not even tell you that they've stopped the iron tablets. So then we come to intravenous iron therapy, and there are still lots of questions with intravenous iron therapy, but we recognize that the two things that we know about intravenous iron, that it does seem to work better than oral iron. This was a randomized control trial that we did many years ago now, and we recognize that the oral iron and the no iron treatment groups did no difference between them. And I think that now, this was long before before hepcidin was invented. I think it's because the patients in this trial took their oral iron because we were very keen on pushing that, but they did not have any effect because none of it was absorbed. And the intravenous iron group did the best. So when this trial was performed in the early 1990s and published in 1996, hepcidin wasn't invented. But we now recognize that hepcidin is invented. This is where the science has taken us. And this is the reason probably why the patients in this study didn't do very well with oral iron. So we have intravenous preparations available throughout Europe. I'm not going to go through the main disadvantages or advantages of them. They are very different. We have high and low molecular weight iron dextrans. We have iron gluconate in countries like Germany and Italy. We have iron sucrose in many countries. And more recently, we've got ferric carboxymaltose licensed in Europe. The products are very different. The doses of amount of iron you can give at any administration is different. The main advantage of the new iron preparation is the ability to give a much higher dose of intravenous iron without resulting in free iron reactions. So what we recognize generally with all IV iron compounds is that intravenous iron can improve anemia even in the absence of ESA therapy. And that was shown very nicely in the Romanian study that was published in NDT many years ago. And we also shown that intravenous iron can significantly enhance the response to EPO therapy even in iron replete patients. So that's the upside of intravenous iron. What is the downside? Well, we have some concerns. Some of them may be less valid than they used to be. We used to be worried about anaphylaxis and killing our patients with iron dextran. I think these days, the concept of a patient dying of intravenous iron is something that we recognize as more history. Yet, we still see free iron reactions with too much iron being given too quickly, and we recognize that causes a bit of distress to the patient, even if it only lasts a few minutes. There are concerns out there, mainly from the laboratory, about increased susceptibility to infection with intravenous iron, increased oxidative stress, and I think these days iron overload shouldn't be an issue because we have some control over not giving too much iron. But these are the concerns perhaps about the tolerability of IV iron. Well, again, where is the science taking us with treating iron deficiency? Is it possible that we could be using some modulator of hepcidin to treat iron deficiency in the future as a target for CKD anemia management? So you'll see that the answers to my three questions that I've posed just over the last 10 minutes or so have really been around the issue of hepcidin. So we've got to discuss a bit about hepcidin now. So what is hepcidin? What does it do? How can we measure it? And what are the implications for the nephrologist? Well, it's a very interesting little molecule. It was discovered, incidentally, by a French medical student about 10 or 11 years ago. We know the gene that regulates this peptide, which is the HAMP gene. The active peptide is 25 amino acids, but the pre-pro peptide is 84 amino acids, and that's cleaved down to the active biological peptide of 25 amino acids, and it's excreted by the kidney. Well, what does it do? It regulates iron metabolism in the body. It's the main iron regulatory hormone that controls how much iron we absorb from the diet on a day-to-day basis. Not only does it control iron absorption, but it controls iron release from the liver and the reticuloendothelial system, such as the spleen and the macrophages, into the plasma. So it is the main gatekeeper of iron regulation feeding the bone marrow. Do we understand the molecular action of hepcidin? Yes, we do. We understand iron transport in a way that we did not understand 10 years ago. We understand that there are molecules such as divalent metal transporter 1, DMT1, that controls iron uptake by cells, and this cell could be a gut mucosal cell or a macrophage. And we recognize at the other end that there's ferroportin that is controlling iron efflux from the cell. And hepcidin really interacts with ferroportin. That's where hepcidin works. So when you have low hepcidin levels, iron floods through the cell and is absorbed readily from the gut into the plasma. Where you have high hepcidin states, such as with chronic inflammation, the ferroportin is immobilized by interacting with hepcidin, and this stops iron getting out of the cell. So it will stop iron crossing the gut mucosa, it will stop iron being released from the macrophages, and this is why our patients get functional iron deficiency. So what controls hepcidin? Well, the main regulator of hepcidin is inflammation. The main molecule driving hepcidin production is interleukin-6, with a lesser extent of tuber necrosis factor alpha. Can we measure hepcidin? Well, 5 years ago, not really. We could maybe get some primitive assays for pro-hepcidin. These days, we have some better assays for measuring the biologically hepcidin 25 in serum. And there are various techniques in the literature now published in the last 2 or 3 years. We have radioimmunoassays, we have ELISA, we have a ligand binding assay in one paper, and we have some mass spectrometry assays using CELDI and MALDI-TOF techniques. And perhaps tandem mass spectrometry as well. And I've summarized all these. There's a review in press in Clinical Journal of American Society of Nephrology where I've talked about all the assays that are currently in the literature for measuring hepcidin in plasma. Now, you can see this summarizes some of the data. You can see these huge peaks from the Thomas Gans assay. This is the assay developed by Thomas Gans, who did all the early work on the hepcidin molecular biology. And you can see that the ELISAs that he uses, which is the competitive ELISA, have about 10 times the level of hepcidin compared to any other assay. And it's clear now that this antibody in the ELISA is picking up more than just hepcidin 25. And the mass spectrometry assays clearly tell us that the normal range for hepcidin in chronic kidney disease is somewhere in the region of 0 to 50 nanogram per mil. So what are the implications of hepcidin for the nephrologist? Well, I think we can say the following so far, and this is a very fast developing field. I think we know that hepcidin is the explanation why many of our patients, particularly those on hemodialysis, are not absorbing oral iron from the gut, and it gives the explanation of why we need to give these patients intravenous iron. It is the pivotal mediator, we think, of functional iron deficiency in inflammatory states that we've been talking about for nearly 20 years now. It's probably the key factor in the pathogenesis of EPO resistance in patients that develop infections or inflammatory states. And once we get the assays optimized, and that's happening month by month, it may be that in the future we'll have hepcidin measurements that may be better in predicting whether patients respond to iron rather than the ferritin and the iron TIBC and hypochromic red cells. So the science is really moving on very rapidly. And the final thing I want to leave you with in the last couple of minutes is it's possible that Hepcidin may be even a potential target for future anemia therapies. And I don't know if you've seen, just last month, there's the first paper that alludes to this being a serious consideration. This is from the Amgen group. This was published in the Journal of Blood a month ago, and this is an antibody that's been developed by Amgen. It's a monoclonal antibody, and this is a mouse model of inflammation to see if the anemia could be corrected by antagonizing Hepcidin. So I think I'll skip this one. Basically, this is just the bullet points from the paper. I'll show you the actual data. So in the bottom, what they did was they took some mice. They gave them an inflammatory state with Brucella abortus, which is the BA on the left hand of the bottom panel. And then they gave increasing concentrations of the monoclonal antibody against Hepcidin in this model. They measured hemoglobin. They gave some of the mice ESA, and they saw what happened. Haven't really got time to do this. If you wish, the reference there is at the bottom. It's Sasu et al., published in Blood, and you can go through this in more detail if you like. But the bottom line for this is that antagonizing Hepcidin would probably improve the response to ESA therapy in inflammatory states. So this might be a potential target. Now, of course, immediately what you're going to say is, how can we give a monoclonal antibody to a dialysis patient, which would have to be given 3 times a week, long-term for life, at a huge cost, because it's not going to be cheap. So it's not necessarily a practical way for patients to use in the future that are inflamed. It might not even be safe. We don't really know. But it's just the concept of the science suggesting that Hepcidin could be a target for anemia of inflammation. So this is my last slide. Patients with CKD are at increased risk of developing iron deficiency. I think I've illustrated that for you, and also Bernard showed some data in relation to that. We have some diagnostic markers available to monitor iron status. Unfortunately, all have limitations. Maybe Hepcidin might be something that is being looked at more. Intravenous iron is beneficial, I think it's fair to say, in patients with non-dialysis CKD, even in the absence of ESA therapy. And we have some newer formulations now, both in the US and in Europe, that might overcome the limitations of the older IV iron preparations. And I've given you a very brief introduction to Hepcidin for those of you that are not familiar with it, just the headlines of Hepcidin as a key regulator of iron availability and the potential for it being a future therapeutic target for managing anemia in chronic kidney disease. Thank you.